Hi, it's Dave. Today, I'm joined by Eric Berger. He is a senior space editor at Ars Technica. He covers SpaceX, space, and related stories. And he recently wrote a book called Liftoff. And Liftoff talks about the early days of SpaceX and Elon Musk and his role in that company. And in my interview with Eric today, I want to focus in on trying to gain some insights on how Elon Musk runs his companies, what are kind of his perspectives and principles that he uses. So welcome to the show, Eric.
Hey, Dave, thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, so I found your book actually pretty fascinating. It's right here. For those who haven't heard about this, Liftoff, Elon Musk gave you the ultimate compliment on Twitter. He said your book was accurate. He said he read it and it was accurate, which is, you know, probably the top of the top compliments from Elon. How did you take that?
Well, first of all, it was great to get that feedback. You know, he's not a big fan of journalists. So he and I have a pretty decent rapport. I think he respects the work I've done. So when I asked him about writing a book on the Falcon 1, he was like, all right, I think it would be good. But his number one dictum to me was, you know, be accurate. Tell the accurate story. So when he said it was accurate on Twitter, I think that was some pretty nice validation that I'd captured the essence of what made the company a success.
Yeah, I mean, your book goes into some really fascinating stories of the super kind of early days, the very, very beginning of SpaceX, how they were able to, you know, launch their first rockets into space, the disappointments that came along, especially with the first failures. I'm curious, how did you arrange this with Elon to actually speak to the early, you know, SpaceX employees, because it seems like you really were able to interview, you know, the key people in the early days.
Yeah. So back in 2019, I basically went to him with a proposal. I said, look, there's a great story to tell about the Falcon 1 rocket. You know, Ashley Vance had written a biography of Elon that was published in 2014 or 2015. He liked some parts of that book, wasn't happy with other parts of the book, but it told the bare bones story of the beginning of SpaceX. And Ashley, I think, did a great job considering, you know, what he had to work with in telling that story. But there was so much more there. And it wasn't just a story about Elon. It was a story about sort of these brilliant engineers that he hired to help him accomplish his vision. So I went to him and basically said, look, I think it's really time to tell the story of the Falcon 1. It's been about 15 years since most of this happened. And I think I could put it in the context of what you were up against. And I think that's what really appealed to him, because I had a broad base of knowledge about NASA and commercial space and really understood that the challenge that a private company faced in putting even a small orbital rocket into space in the early 2000s. So I said, you know, I'd love to tell the story. He said, okay. And by him sort of being willing to talk to me, that signaled to former employees that you know, that they were invited to talk to me. And frankly, you know, I was invited to come out to the factory on multiple occasions to speak to people who were there for the Falcon 1 days who were still at the company. And so he was really very welcoming for that part of the story. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. So did kind of this go through email? Kind of you gave him a proposal and he like okayed it and then he started to open himself to talk with, or how did that happen?
So it started out with me contacting the SpaceX communications person mm-hmm. by email and having communication with him. And then he took the idea to Elon, and initially I think Elon rejected it. I was told he'd had a bad day. then at some point the PR person took it back to him, James, and Elon was much more receptive. And so I never spoke to him directly about the book, actually, until my first interview with him in September of 2019.
Awesome. And what was kind of your interaction with Elon during this book writing process? How many interviews did you have with him? Like, how many days were you, let's say, around him? And how did you observe kind of his kind of role with SpaceX?
Yeah, so there were three main interactions. One of the things was he wanted me to get a sense of his leadership style and how he runs meetings and sort of the engineering detail to which he goes into these projects. And so on one occasion, over the course of several days, I went out to their factory in Hawthorne, California. This was in 2019, and sat in on meetings where they were discussing Starship and the Raptor rocket engine and the Starlink internet program and Dragon. And so it was, you know, multiple meetings over multiple days and in his executive conference room. It was basically this room in the middle of the factory in SpaceX where there's a U-shaped table, and he kind of sits at one end of the table, and there's a handful of senior engineers sitting around the table, and there's a bunch of younger engineers kind of standing around the edge of the room, and they go through various technical issues they're having, and he sort of gives his ideas for solutions or tells them what he would do or ask them for help. You know, they needed, you know, at that point they were finalizing the first mock-up of the Starship vehicle called Starship Mark One, and they really needed welders. And so he's like, okay, I'm going to call this person, and you know, get you the help you need. So it was that kind of thing. And then the second main interaction was I had gone out to California and was supposed to have an interview with him for a couple of hours again at the in his office at the factory. And it was a Friday night, and his assistant texted and said he'd had some problem basically come up, and he was very sorry, but he couldn't do the interview. And so I was preparing to fly back to Houston, and I got back to my hotel in LA, and then got a message again from the assistant who said he's flying to Boca Chica tomorrow, South Texas, from LA, and you know, maybe you could do the interview on the plane. And so what happened was, this was in September, I ended up flying with him and three of his sons on his jet from LA to Texas, and so it was like literally about 2.5 hours with him in the back of the plane, sitting around a table with him telling stories about the Falcon 1 days. And that was really pretty special, because if you know Elon at all, he does not like to talk about the past. He's very much focused on the future. And he likes to talk about technical things. He doesn't like to talk about feelings. And so I was lucky. I got him in a mood where he was pretty thoughtful about sort of some of these memories from the Falcon 1 days. And so we went through the starting of the company and through sort of things he remembered about each of those first four launches of the Falcon 1 rocket. And then after we landed in Brownsville, it was sort of late afternoon, and he ended up, you know, staying until after midnight at the Starship build site down there. And he let me tag along with him as he went through there and met with engineers and sort of discussed problems. And so again, that was sort of a probably 6 to 8 hour period. And then in 2020, just before the pandemic really took hold, I went down again to Boca Chica, sort of to see the progress that they'd made on Starship, and also talked to him for about another hour and a half of interview in that time. And then this last summer, we had some emails and phone calls as I was getting sort of some final details for the book.
Awesome. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. On the plane ride from LA to Boca Chica, did you have a recording? Were you audio recording kind of the interview as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any plans of releasing that, or are you able to release it? Or I mean, that would be fascinating to hear. I mean, the book is awesome, but it'd be great to, you know, have a raw audio recording as well.
I'll have to think about it.
Okay, awesome, man. No, I think a ton of people would love that. You could put it up on YouTube or, you know, anywhere. Yeah, and I would definitely promote it. I'm curious, did Elon have to give kind of this like formal okay for you to talk with other early SpaceX employees, or just by him meeting with you, did that just signal like just, you know, intuitively to people that it's okay for them to talk with you? And how, like, for the more specifically, how did you approach these early SpaceX employees? Was it basically, I'm writing a book and, you know, I'd like to kind of hear some stories from the early days?
Yeah. So for the people who were still at SpaceX, it was very much of a, like, they were just scheduled for long sit down interviews with me, at the factory. And on several occasions, I say I went out there and did those, and it was sort of, you know, very much like they all knew what was going on, and now they were telling stories and that sort of thing. But a lot of the key people no longer worked at the company. Some of the early vice presidents and their key people, and I obviously wanted to talk to them. And it turned out they were all eager to talk and tell those stories, because they felt like the Falcon 1 story had really gone untold. And it was really just as simple as finding an email or a phone number for them and reaching out and saying, hey, my name is Eric Berger. I write about space. And most of them knew me because I'm fairly well read in the space industry. So they'd seen my work on SpaceX and other companies. But then it was very comfortable to be able to say, look, you know, Elon's on board with the project. And then they might either start talking then, or they may want to go back and check and see, make sure Elon was on board. Because even though they left SpaceX, they still respected, feared, I'm not sure which one, but you know, they wanted to make sure that, you know, it was kosher, that I wasn't just, you know, coming out of the blue.
Yeah.
And then once that was clear, you know, it was very sort of candid interviews, and then going back to them and checking facts. We said, here's a story from one person. Then I go back to another one and say, hey, do you remember this? What's your take on it? And that kind of thing.
How long was the research and then the writing process altogether for you?
So I started doing interviews, I think, in May of 2019 or June. And then I submitted my, rough draft around March of 2020. It was like almost a year, and then a bunch of editing over last summer and fall, and then the final product was done like in October, I guess.
Awesome. Yeah, after reading your book, I was deeply impressed, and I wrote a tweet. I'm like, yeah, SpaceX should document more of, you know, what's going on, like even visually. And I'm like, if they had like a documentary team, or even one person kind of every 3 months kind of filming and kind of sharing the story and releasing it, it'd be just fabulous. I'm curious, with you as a writer, do you have any other plans to write more books on SpaceX? Like, for example, because your book covered the early days, probably, you know, do you have plans on covering, you know, Falcon 9 or even Starship in the future?
So, yeah, it's too early to write the Starship story, because they're still very much in the development phase. And about 90% of that book has yet to be written in terms of history. I do think it would be interesting to go back and really understand how they tackled reuse, specifically the Falcon 9, but also in Starship, because that really is the main technical challenge that they addressed over the last decade. Not just recovering the rockets, which is super impressive, but then turning them around and flying them again and again and again. So rapid, low cost reuse. So probably I'll work on that book. I haven't signed any kind of official contract with a publisher yet, though.
Awesome. I noticed one of the themes or approaches or angles of your book is you kind of center around people. So you have Elon Musk and his vision, his determination, but then you've got these other kind of key leaders and engineers who take on various roles, and they all have their own type of set of challenges and drama. You know, some make mistakes that haunt them, some, you know, they overcome the mistakes, etc. This whole kind of approach of SpaceX in the early days being about people, being about, you know, Elon, but also these other kind of key engineers and the drama, you know, in those early days and what it took to overcome. Was that something that you decided, like, early on, or as while you're researching, did that come together as more of kind of the backdrop of the book?
So it was a conscious decision early on to make it a SpaceX book and not just about Elon, as compelling a figure as he is. You know, as I mentioned, you know, he'd had a biography written about him that was pretty good. And so I didn't want to recreate that. At the same time, you know, the early employees, some of them, you know, are public names, like Gwynne Shotwell, Tom Mueller is known in the rocket, you know, industry, and a few other people kind of have some names, but a lot of the people in the book really have no public profile whatsoever. And so it was a conscious desire for me to tell the story through a set of characters. About 10 or 12 main characters was my original idea, Elon being one of them. But only one of them. And then sort of going through the trials and tribulations and ultimately the successes of the company through their eyes. And so I spend the first half of the book introducing a number of these characters. And then the second half of the book is really kind of this roller coaster ride where they're, you know, they're failing and almost sort of coming to a complete disaster before ultimately succeeding.
Mm-hmm. I noticed comparing your book with Ashley Vance's biography, I noticed it was very different in the sense that I felt like Ashley Vance's biography, it portrayed Elon as more of a volatile type of emotional person who at times would, let's say, hold grudges or, you know, do things that just seemed a little bit kind of out there. I felt like your book, it portrayed Elon more as a stable kind of person, as a person who, you know, was determined, held kind of more of a stable type of rock kind of role in the whole story of SpaceX. There were times where there were tensions and disagreements and issues with various people, but it felt like those were just, you know, different instances. They weren't the whole picture, the whole story. And I felt like your portrayal of Elon was much more, I guess, less dramatic, you know, than Ashley Vance's. Can you share kind of your take on how you viewed Elon Musk, or how Elon Musk came to life in your research through your interviews, spending time with him? And was it different than what you expected Elon Musk to be? And was it different than what, let's say, Ashley Vance portrayed in his biography?
He largely met my expectations. I had times before writing the book, and he's an intimidating guy, right? Brilliant. The book sort of captures his determination and willingness to stick with this goal. Like, he founded SpaceX in 2002 with the intent to create a settlement on Mars with humans. And that's still his goal today. And like, all of the decisions he's making at SpaceX are bent toward ultimately achieving that goal. And so he's very much stable in that. It's definitely accurate to say, though, he's prone to outbursts, and when things go wrong, you know, he will chew asses and you know, do things that are pretty harsh. But the fact of the matter is, you know, you don't come to dominate the automobile industry or literally transform the space industry without, you know, breaking eggs, right? He's not walking on eggshells. He's picking up the eggs and throwing them against the wall and basically doing what needs to be done to clear the way toward these ambitions. And you're going to upset people. And yeah, maybe his personality isn't for everyone. He's very bombastic on Twitter. He's a complex person, but he's also doing the kinds of things, you know, it's the world is pushing back on everything that he's trying to do. And so you've got to be pretty abrasive to sort of continue that forward motion for going on two decades now with SpaceX and Tesla.
Mm-hmm. I think your book, it portrayed an angle of Elon that I thought was fascinating, and that is one of an engineer. So engineer first, and then also deeply involved in these engineering meetings and really contributing like the key engineering decisions and somehow leading a team through engineering, the model of engineering. And I haven't really seen that type of kind of portrayal of Elon done in other, you know, publications or articles or videos so much. I feel like you encapsulated this angle of Elon that I think he resonates with, that he's talked about in the past, where he first and foremost views himself as an engineer. And I'm curious, can you expound kind of on how you discovered that and how important was that type of engineering first, you know, attitude in SpaceX in the early days and even until now?
So yeah, one of my major goals with Liftoff was to really understand how much of the success of SpaceX could be put down to Elon Musk versus luck versus other factors. And so that's a question that I asked everyone I talked to, people still at the company, but more importantly, former employees, to get kind of a candid assessment of what Elon's contributions were. And everyone I talked to said that when it came to making the hardest engineering decisions, you know, he was in the room, you know, making those decisions and then owning them. Pretty illustrative example, I think, on the second flight of the Falcon 1 rocket. They had lots of issues, lots of risks on this flight. It was a test flight. They didn't even put a payload on it. And one of the things that they were a little bit concerned about was the second stage. So this is after it gets into space, the second stage separates from the first stage. And then it uses its propellant, liquid oxygen and kerosene to continue upward into orbit, ultimately putting a satellite in orbit. They were concerned that the fuel, as it drained out of this tank and the tank emptied, would start sloshing around. And so they did a bunch of computer modeling. A guy named Steve Davis modeled all sorts of scenarios and basically came to the conclusion that, look, there's lots of things that have to go wrong for slosh to crop up and scuttle the mission. And it turned out this was the 11th risk of that particular mission for the avionics section of the rocket. And so Elon heard all that in the meeting and sort of signed off on these risks and sort of accepted the fact that Slosh was a potential risk. And they, and critically, they decided not to fix it. Now, what would it have taken to fix it? They could have done two things. They could have spent, you know, more time and more money simulating Slosh, developed more advanced models and run it more. And that might have delayed the launch for weeks or months. Or they could have inserted baffles, sort of these structures in the second stage that would help orient the flow of the propellant down toward the engine and ensure that it didn't, you know, spin out of control. And that would have added mass to the structure of the rocket and taken away performance. And so if they didn't have to add baffles, they sure didn't want to, because it was just a net negative on performance. And again, added cost and time. And this was a lean company, you know, working at the time on private money, trying to go fast. And so he accepted the risk. And then after the flight, you know, he owned it, that was a mistake that he and SpaceX had made. And he didn't get mad at Steve Davis, who'd done the modeling, or the avionics team, because it was, you know, he'd accepted that risk and knew it sort of with eyes wide open. So he had the vision for SpaceX, right? No question about that. And that sustained SpaceX to this day. But it is accurate to say that he was in the room, like where it happened, like day after day, you know, moving those teams along. And yeah, he didn't make every decision, but he made all the important decisions, ultimately. And he secured the funding, and he, you know, he promoted Gwynne Shotwell to deal with NASA and the Department of Defense. Now, he made mistakes. His first choice for president and chief operating officer is not Gwynne Shotwell. It was a guy named Jim Mazur, who came to the company from Sea Launch, and he proved to be, you know, just a bad cultural fit. So Elon made plenty of mistakes, but, you know, much of the success is directly attributable to him. And another reason to believe that is that he was not the first person to come along and say, we're going to be the FedEx of space. You know, we're going to be the company that does things faster and better and cheaper than NASA and Lockheed and Boeing. You know, we're going to be a private company. You know, half a dozen or more companies had come along saying similar kinds of things to what Elon said, and they'd all failed. They'd all gone bankrupt. And SpaceX very nearly went bankrupt. They had some luck, right? But they made it, and now they are what they are today. And it's you would not have a SpaceX without Elon Musk, and it would be a very different company if he were no longer there.
Interesting. These engineering meetings that you were able to attend with Elon Musk, how are they run? Is there someone else, like a senior engineer, who presents kind of what they're doing, some challenges, and Elon chimes in, or is like,
yeah,
what's the format?
So at least in the meetings I was in, there was some basic agenda. And so like where the leader of the Starlink program or whatever part of the Starlink program they were talking about would raise some issues or basically give Elon a progress update. And so they would have a presentation or be talking to him, and then he would just sort of jump in with questions or comments. And if there was something he didn't like, he would let the people know. And you know, so he could be, you know, pretty blunt or abrasive, but it was funny because like he would do that, and then he would seek to then often lighten the mood. And so he would sort of go from being pretty blunt to then sort of making a joke and then kind of iterating on that joke, and then everyone is sort of laughing along. So I would not say the meetings were particularly tense, but they were definitely like the defining characteristic of Elon Musk is that he wants to get things done. Like he is laser focused on accomplishing whatever goals are before him. And so like he would always ask, can we do this faster? Can we do this different? Why do you need to do this? Why can't we do this? You know, if you've got a problem, email me at 3 a.m. or whenever, and I'll see what I can do about it. And so because of who Elon is now, you know, he can pick up the phone and call almost anyone in the world and, you know, make things happen. And so he wanted his engineers to know that if they ran into a problem, They needed more welders. They needed to get a construction elevator on a site in McGregor, Texas the next day. You know, whatever the problems were, he wanted a chance to help them solve them.
Interesting. When, let's say, an engineer is presenting a progress report in the meeting, is this directed to Elon specifically? Is the meeting like for Elon to hear this and to give input? Is that kind of the gist of the meetings?
Yes, okay. That's precisely what it was. It was, he was sitting there getting this presentation, and then having a discussion with his project leaders.
And how many, like, how long would these meetings go for, at least the ones that you attended?
So the ones I sat in on were generally 45 minutes to an hour. And what was amazing to me is, so when he started SpaceX, Elon hired about four or five vice presidents who were about 40 years old. So these were people who'd been in the space industry and had some experience and, you know, could help lead the company. And then his primary engineering workforce were undergraduates and graduate students at Stanford, USC, you know, MIT, sort of the best schools in the country, who were, you know, compelled to come out there and sort of try to help him achieve what he was, you know, to get to orbit. And so the workforce was very young and willing to work these long hours. What was striking to me was 20 years later, or it wasn't 20 years later, but it was almost 20 years later at these meetings, the room was filled with young people, mostly in their 20s. I mean, there were a few older people in their 30s and maybe a couple in their 40s. But Elon was the oldest person in the room. You know, he's almost 50. And it was just young, energetic, brilliant engineers, you know, third, fourth, fifth, sixth generation since the early Falcon 1 days. But you know, other organizations really run into this, like NASA, the average age of the workforce at NASA is like 50 years old. And so it's a good thing and it's a bad thing at SpaceX. Like it's an exhausting work environment, but it continues to attract young people willing to make their mark on space.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How do you think Elon keeps up with all of the engineering that's going on? Is it kind of divvied up where he has, you know, these senior engineers who are managing their own teams and he's meeting with the most important type of engineers, you know, representing the most important parts, or is he managing the whole engineering of everything? Like, does everyone report to him, or are there some type of, you know, structures where he's just, you know, somehow selectively, you know, choosing what's the most important things?
So there are definitely departments at SpaceX. Like, there's mission assurance, there's propulsion, you know, there's this and that. But he's very hands on. He manages everything. So, you know, he cares about everything from the details in press releases to the paint color schemes on minor parts of the engine to sort of whatever, what have you. Like, he's knowledgeable about all these things. And so he has these meetings with the senior engineers, but I think he also talks to sort of people on the line as well, sort of, you know, to get their input and things like that. It has a remarkable capacity for information, I'll say that. Mm.
What's crazy is he's doing all this alongside, you know, running an electric car company, one of the largest companies in the world. Did you see any evidence of him like batch meeting his schedule? Like, for example, setting aside a few days of just all SpaceX, you know, and then having to fly out to somewhere else just to do only Tesla. I mean, was that kind of his general approach to taking all these meetings?
Yeah, you know, I think it varies depending on where the current crisis is, or where the most, where what he thinks the most important thing is. So I think in 2018, or around that time frame when he was in production hell with Tesla, he was spending, you know, almost all of his time at Tesla. I think in 2020 that really flipped back to SpaceX. You know, he was spending 5 or 6 days a week in Boca Chica in South Texas because for him, the most important thing he was working on was Starship. And so that's where he wanted to be to push the progress on that forward. But, you know, on average, I would say he spends 2 to 3 days a week on Tesla and 2 to 3 days a week on SpaceX, another time for Neuralink and the Boring Company. You know, he gets up, you know, fairly late in the morning and then works till very, very late at night. Mm.
Interesting. Do you foresee, or do you think Elon is eventually going to just focus on SpaceX? Like, is that his, you think, his enduring passion, kind of the thing that he's going to be involved with most long term? Or do you see some type of hybrid where his role with Tesla will continue on, let's say, even, into the next decade or two?
I don't know. It has to have been exhausting to try to manage both of those companies for the last 15 to 18 years. But he's managed to do it. I think we can go back to 2008 and get a sense of where his passions lie. That was in that fall. He had basically run out of money, and SpaceX was on the verge of bankruptcy, and Tesla was on the verge of bankruptcy. And he had the choice of trying to save one or the other, but he was being told by all of his friends he had to let one of them go. He refused to let one of them go, and ultimately both companies were saved. But I think he values them both greatly. I can really only speak to SpaceX in terms of his passions, because we haven't talked a whole lot about Tesla. I'm not a Tesla expert by any stretch of the imagination, but in his heart of hearts, Mars is extremely important to what he wants to do. So I do not think he will stop pushing aggressively until humans are landing on Mars, and not just like the first mission, till like there's a sustaining settlement there.
Interesting. So one of the my favorite parts of your book was this one section where I think you're interviewing Elon, and he's saying Bezos is just not a good engineer. And then he says, then Elon replies with a few things. He says, first, I'm like a super good engineer, right? Like that's one thing. And then he says, number
Very
two,
modest.
yeah. He says, number two, I'm really good at spotting if a person is a good engineer or not, And he could spot it fairly quickly and within 15 minutes, if not after a couple of days of working with them, right? And then the third thing is he replies saying, I'm really good at driving like engineering efficiency, like the efficiency in engineering teams, right? And when I was reading that, I'm like, wow, like it seems like almost this completely different approach to running a company as a CEO, right? I mean, typically, let's say you go to MBA management school or something, it's all about strategy, and it's all about business plans, and it's all about these lofty just marketing and different stuff. But Elon brings it down to it's like he's a great engineer, he's going to pick great engineers, and he's going to drive them to get great results, and that's like the core of the company. More specifically, I guess my question is, how is Elon kind of getting the most out of his engineers? Like, what are some of the approaches, some of the techniques, some of the things that he's doing to really drive them to get these crazy results that they're getting?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and very insightful, Dave, to the company's success. So he has always invested an enormous amount of time and energy into hiring. His HR, chief of HR, told me that Elon personally hired the first 3,000 employees of the company. Most of those were engineers, of course. So that tells you something about the amount of value he invests in sort of hiring talent. And he's able to attract, smart people who are willing to work super hard, because A, he's got a compelling vision, B, he's got the resources to carry out that vision, and C, they can come to SpaceX and know that they're going to make a difference. If they went to NASA or a large space company, or aerospace company like Lockheed or Boeing, typically if you're an engineer, you're probably sitting behind a desk, working on paperwork or, whatever. And then of course you do paperwork at SpaceX, but there's a much greater focus on building, testing, flying, learning from those mistakes and flying again. And so, they do blow things up like you've seen with Starship in South Texas, but that's part of the allure. I mean, if you go work at SpaceX, you're touching, you're building hardware, and you're gonna get a field test within months, right? You're gonna get to see those things fly. And then when they succeed, you share in that success. And when it fails, you're like, okay, what do we need to learn from this to go out and succeed next time? So it's remarkably rewarding for young engineers to go there because it's hands-on. And of course, the experience you get from SpaceX, you can take on to a number of other careers. You know, you're very, obviously, it's marketable in terms of the skill set you have. And he gets, you know, how does he get that out of them? Again, it's sort of this vision that they can help fulfill. And he's very good at motivating it. Steve Davis, one of the early engineers, told me the story about how Elon would place little bets with him. Like, I don't think, you know, I'll bet, you know, we can, you know, you can't get this done by such and such a date. And Steve told me that one of the things, you know, they were doing some really important simulation on a later Falcon 1 launch. And Elon said, you know, I'll bet you can't get it done by such and such a date. And Steve Davis was like, well, maybe we can. And then Elon said, if you get it done by this date, I'll buy a frozen yogurt machine for the cafeteria. And Davis at that point was like, well, there's no way we weren't getting it done. So, you know, his unique way of motivating people by sort of reward, I think fear probably pays a little bit into it because you don't really want to upset Elon. You don't want to be on his bad side. But it is part of, like, you go there because you believe in the cause. And if you believe in the cause, you're willing to give it all. Another engineer, Flo Lee, you know, she was a graduate student at Stanford University. This was in 2003. I mean, she had a great life up there. She had social, she had friends. She was on the swim team. You know, she just was like loving life. And SpaceX came calling. And so she said she took the job in LA and didn't know anybody down there. And she said, you know, as she drove into the valley, you know, for the first time, she started crying because she's like, what am I doing? You know, it's the smog, it's traffic. I don't know anybody here. I don't have any friends. And she said that didn't last very long because when she got to SpaceX and started working, she didn't have a time for social life. She's like, she didn't need friends. Like everyone, all the people in her life were in that factory and working at SpaceX. And that became her entire family and friends in Los Angeles. And she said, after a few weeks, she said, I came to the realization that at that moment in my life, that was all that mattered to me. I was so invested in this goal and wanting the company to succeed and believing what we were doing. It was okay that I was, you know, working 70, 80, 90 hours a week at that job because that was the all-encompassing thing in my life at that moment that I wanted to work on. And that is not commonplace, I don't think, a lot of companies, although it is at some, but Musk has this way of sort of, you know, engendering that in his employees by giving them really difficult goals and then helping them achieve those goals. And then when they reach those goals, he raises the bar higher and says, okay, now you need to go do this. Mm-hmm. So it never really stops.
Yeah, it's fascinating because when I look at SpaceX, it's one of those companies that has perhaps some of the loftiest goals, you know, possible. They're almost, in a sense, unbelievable in their scope. And I think there's something inspirational about that, you know, trying to reach for something that's so big. And then it's interesting how Elon can pair it with these really specific meetings and then perhaps say, okay, next week, show me what you got, like, give me an update. And I wonder if that type of combination where you got the long-term motivation and goal, right, combined with the day-to-day execution of, hey, okay, that's a great progress report, but, you know, here's some ideas, try it out, you know, and give me a report next week. I wonder if that's one of the reasons why Elon's so hands-on, because he could, in a way, influence the day-to-day so much. He could, you know, impact how fast each engineering team is moving by meeting with them and then giving them maybe a short-term goal, like a week or two out. Did you see any evidence of that, of him kind of like saying, okay, I want something, you know, a report or something, you know, in the next week or two after a meeting?
I think it was clear to me that, you know, him being around, you know, impels people to move forward. Like there's this scene at the beginning of Return of the Jedi in Star Wars where the Emperor visits the Death Star, right? To see how construction is going. And it's a little too dramatic to say that about SpaceX and Elon, I think, but when he visits like the launch site or the build site Starship, like everybody raises their game because he just sort of has this will where he sort of impels people to move forward at speed. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's basically been living in Boca Chica for the last year and a half. I don't think it's particularly because he wanted to be in South Texas, but it's because he felt like he needed to be there to make sure that program was moving forward at all speed possible.
Mm-hmm. With engineering, what would be a bad fit, like, for, you know, as an engineer at SpaceX, like, that wouldn't get along with Elon, wouldn't get along with SpaceX, but just, you know, like, how would you describe that type of bad fit engineer?
So the worst kind of fit of an engineer would be someone who'd worked at another company, a Boeing or Lockheed, and like had some success there, but then thought that they knew how to do things. Like, if that person went to SpaceX in a meeting and they were talking about, you know, doing a engine development one way, that person said, that's a terrible idea. You know, that's always been done this way. Like, the last thing Elon wants to hear is that, you know, this is the way it's always been done. So like, one of the reasons why I think he wants younger engineers is because he wants people who have not been molded, right? Or conditioned to think that, well, it's always been done this way, and so we can't, you know, think outside of the box. You know, a great example was with the Dragon spacecrafts, the Cargo Dragon spacecraft. They needed a space-rated latch basically to open these pressurized lockers in the Dragon to store refrigerated things for the time from launch till it got to the space station. And the vendor in the industry was selling them, I don't know, maybe for like $5,000 or $10,000 a latch, right? Because they were the vendor of space-rated latches or whatever. Of course, SpaceX would always look for a way to do things in-house or save money or whatever, you know, whatever way possible. They didn't want to do that because that's the way it always been done for. I mean, it's the easiest thing way, right? You just go buy your latches there. You don't have to test them. One of the engineers was in the bathroom at the factory in Hawthorne, California, and looked at the latch on the door to the toilet. I guess he was sitting down. I don't know. And took the idea of that latch and said, hey, I'll bet we could adapt this latch to be for Cargo Dragon. And so the Cargo Dragon spacecraft have lockers with latches that are based on the latches in the SpaceX bathrooms. So, I mean, it's that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That,
yeah.
That he doesn't want people who think who are not, well, he wants you to think outside of the box and think creatively and find new solutions to old problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It's definitely fascinating stuff. So today at the time of this recording, NASA announced that SpaceX has won their $2.9 billion award to send humans back to Mars for the human lunar landing system. How significant is that for SpaceX? Does this impact, you know, what they're doing, and yeah, what is the meaning of kind of this award from NASA to SpaceX?
So this is an extraordinary award, I think, for two reasons. First of all, if you go back to 2016, this is when Elon at the International Astronautical Congress in Mexico unveiled sort of what would become Starship for the first time, this really ambitious program. And like, there was no way they were going to be able to fund this on their own, it seemed at the time. I mean, he put up a slide that sort of asked the funding question. One of the things was underneath it was they were going to sell underpants, right? It's kind of like a joke, sort of acknowledging that this was going to cost a lot of money and it was going to be difficult. So he's found funding to sort of develop Starship, and they've made significant progress, although they still have a long way to go. You know, getting $2.9 billion from NASA basically ensures that Starship is going to become a mature technology. And it also means that NASA is going to be there helping, right, with all the human rated stuff, and NASA has all this experience. And so it worked very well during Commercial Crew Program, where they built Crew Dragon, and now they have that for Starship as well. So that's huge, the validation of NASA and the funding. And number two, you know, SpaceX, when I was, you know, what the time period I wrote about the Falcon 1 days, they were absolutely, in Gwen Shotwell's words, she was the president of the company, the jackasses of the space industry, right? They're running around blowing up rockets in Kwajalein, very scrappy bunch, you know, and over the last decade, they've gone from David to Goliath. And the Human Landing System Award, which this is just a development contract and for two missions. And so if they get to an operational point where they're flying these missions to the moon, you know, it's probably $1 billion or $2 billion per pop, per flight. It's a huge amount of money for SpaceX. This was the most consequential NASA contract for human spaceflight in a decade. And they were competing against Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, all of the players in the industry. Blue Origin came out, this is Jeff Bezos' space company, and like designed a lander exactly along the lines of what NASA was asking for, a three-stage lander, kind of like Apollo, fairly straightforward. And they got Lockheed Martin on their team, Northrop, and Draper, this company that's pretty well regarded in avionics, and Blue Origin was going to integrate it. And so like you had this mixture of new space and old space, you know, Bezos was going to fund the engine development for the lander, that kind of thing. So it was like a significant team. And then there were other competitors as well. And out of all this, SpaceX proposes this huge vehicle. Starship is massively oversized for a lunar lander. If you look at a picture of Starship compared to the Dynetics lander or the Blue Origin lander, it's like, you know, it's like Shaquille O'Neal and then, you know, some infants on the ground. It's massively oversized. It's got to be refueled in low Earth orbit and it's technically challenging. They're blowing them up in South Texas. And yet they're the ones, because they've got this innovative design and they self-invested all this money and they've asked for the least amount of money. NASA's like, this is the one we can afford right now. And we think that long term, this is probably the most sustainable way to go to the moon and eventually to Mars. It's just huge that they have come so far so fast, and then to pull down this contract and a sole source award is just, as I say, it was extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
How many years is this award for? Like, what's the duration?
So it's not exactly a time frame. It's $2.9 billion for some development work for Starship, and then they've got two missions. The first one is an uncrewed test flight. So Starship will go to lunar orbit, go down to the moon and come back to lunar orbit. And then the other flight would actually be the first crewed flight down to the surface of the moon. That could be in 2024. It could be 2025 or 2026. That would actually be the first human landing on the moon since the Apollo program. And then after that, then there will be a whole new series of contracts for operational missions. And you've got to believe that SpaceX would be a favorite to win that if they deliver on their first missions.
Sure. And especially if Starship is, you know, flawlessly going back and forth, you know, from space.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So Starship, you know, this is the big focus of SpaceX and Elon Musk right now, trying to get this, you know, to not just to fly, but to land correctly as well.
Yeah.
What's the timeline? Like, you know, is it just kind of up in the air until they fix all the things they need to fix? Or do you think this thing is going to be, you know, running flights sometimes this year or next year in terms of actually carrying satellites, you know, into space or not?
I think satellites in space are kind of a ways off. So it's a step-by-step process. So they've shown so far that they can go up to about 10 kilometers under controlled flight and they can make that belly flop maneuver and sort of come back and reorient themselves for landing. They're having some challenges relighting the Raptor engines using propellant in the header tank of the vehicle. We'll see if they get that resolved with this next flight, which could come up next week or probably before the end of April. That's the SN-15 vehicle. So showing that they can land Starship and sort of getting that engineering success is their next step. And then I think they're gonna continue working on Starship, maybe flying it higher. But Starship is not the vehicle that takes off from the surface of the Earth and goes in orbit. It needs a booster, and it needs a pretty big booster. It's called Super Heavy. Interesting thing about that, they just got approval from the Federal Aviation Administration to build a launch tower in South Texas for Super Heavy. And it's like 479 feet tall, and that's almost as half as tall as the Eiffel Tower. It's like 45% of the height of the Eiffel Tower, so it's just massive, right? That's for the rocket, the first stage rocket. It's got at least 25 of these Raptor engines, and so they've built one of those super heavy rockets to see what it was like to build it, and now they're dismantling that, and they're going to build a second one, and that second one may do sort of a short test flight, but they've got to continue developing Starship and then at the same time build the rocket, which launches it to orbit. And so it's conceivable that you could have a stacked Starship on top of a Super Heavy launch before the end of this year, but there would be no payload inside that. I think maybe next year, I think they'll get to the point where they can get Starship into orbit and maybe start deploying some Starlink satellites. They're not going to put commercial satellites on that anytime soon, because mm-hmm. The Falcon 9 and the Falcon Heavy are just too good, too reliable, and they can fly those low cost for now. Mm-hmm. But they're going to have trouble landing Starships from orbit. That'll be a big challenge too. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Starlink, how important is Starlink to SpaceX? I mean, is it, you know, their main cash cow, their main type of, you know, revenue source to, you know, fund the next decade? And I guess another question is, like, what's the status? Like, is everything just going smoothly? Are they just rolling it out as planned? And, you know, what's kind of the inside scoop on Starlink?
Well, I don't have the inside scoop on Starlink, but from the outside, it does look like it's rolling out fairly smoothly, and they're not far off their timelines. I think most of the United States and other places around the world will be able to get some kind of beta access to Starlink before the end of this year. And that means they'll have put up thousands and thousands of these satellites. And they're launching about 120 a month this year. So that's a pretty good cadence. And the initial user experiences are pretty good. I mean, they say it's a beta, but they're getting good downlink speeds. There's no latency, and the system's relatively easy to set up. So I think they're making good progress. The reason I think Starlink exists is because of Mars. You know, NASA is probably ultimately going to pay for some crewed missions to the surface of Mars to send astronauts to do science and things like that. And that, I think, will be enormously helpful for SpaceX in terms of life support. Because NASA has decades of experience of long-duration spaceflight on the International Space Station, that kind of thing. And then, but there's, you know, going to Mars is just so much more, because it's not a short mission down the surface and back. You know, it's 6 months to get there, and then probably it's 18 months on the surface, and then 6 months to come back. And so you need a habitat on the surface of Mars. You need to figure out what people are going to eat for that long, what clothes they're going to wear. They're going to need power on the surface of Mars, and that's probably like a nuclear reactor, a small space-based nuclear reactor on the surface of Mars to provide ongoing power. So there's all these challenges. So I think NASA will help SpaceX with the technology and sort of support that, because it goes hand in glove with what NASA wants to do. But then there's no immediate profit in Musk's goal of settling Mars. And he and I have talked about this, and he figures that to have what he wants is a self-sustaining settlement on the surface of Mars. So that's enough food and the ability to grow food and the manufacturing tools and the ability to make habitats. And basically, if they were cut off from Earth, they could survive for a certain period of time, you know, on the resources available to them. So what would it take to get to a self-sustaining settlement on Mars? And he says at least 1 million tons would need to be shipped from Earth to the surface of Mars. Now, that's a lot of stuff, because, you know, we were all celebrating about a month ago when NASA landed the Perseverance rover on Mars. And that was an extraordinary achievement. You know, they're going to fly a helicopter and do some other interesting things with Perseverance. That rover is 1 ton. So he's like, it's got to be 1 million tons. Well, let me tell you, getting 1 million tons, even with a low-cost, reusable orbital launch system like Starship, is extraordinarily expensive. And there's no profit. No one is going to pay for a settlement on the surface of Mars. Okay, maybe you as a settler buy a $10,000 ticket. That doesn't come close to like defraying the cost of SpaceX for all of these activities. And so Starlink, I think, is a bet, the first solution possibly to paying for that. Because if Starlink becomes a real thing, it could be worth billions of dollars a year ultimately in revenue to SpaceX, and that could fund the settlement program for Mars.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Starbase. So Elon Musk has tweeted that, you know, he's encouraging people to move to near Boca Chica. They want to incorporate a new city called Starbase, I guess, in preparation for people to go to Mars. But also, I guess it's for SpaceX employees as well. But what kind of information can you give about Starbase? I've been kind of doing my own digging, and I'm trying to figure out, like, you know, there's a Boca Chica village, which is really small. Is that where Starbase is going to be? Can I move to Starbase? Like, can I, like, build a house or buy a house, or, you know, what's going on here?
So there's a couple things going on. First of all, Elon likes the name Starbase, I guess. So he's sort of fixated on that. To incorporate, so let's step back a little bit. Before SpaceX came to South Texas, there was a small community there called Boca Chica Village. And this was a few dozen residents that, you know, did not have, there was not water service from, so it had to be trucked in. It was pretty remote. And, you know, the homes are pretty ramshackle. Most of them, there's a couple nicer homes, but they're not like, it wasn't like palatial oceanfront estates. It was, you know, pretty modest community near the beach there. And SpaceX came in and said, okay, you know, we're going to launch 10 Falcon 9 rockets a year, and it's not going to be that disruptive. Well, you know, 7 years later, they're building massive orbital starships and talking about building this huge orbital launch facility. People, you know, they can't have homeowners there really unless they're like SpaceX people. So they've kind of pushed them out, and like they've tried to buy out everyone, and there's still a few holdouts left, and it's kind of an ugly situation that they're trying to get resolved. But the Starbase would be Boca Chica Village. And in Texas, to be incorporated as a city or a town or village, you have to have, I think it's 2,000 residents, something like that. So I think SpaceX would like fill that area with trailers, or maybe they're going to build some housing there for SpaceX employees. But I don't think you, Dave, could go buy a house in Boca Chica Village or Starbase, Texas. What he would like to see is more development of Brownsville, because that's a pretty poor area of Texas. Certainly before SpaceX got there, it was not known as a technology hub, like an Austin or a Houston or a Dallas, right? It was, you know, kind of a backwater of the state. And so he's come in there and he's brought a lot of cachet to that region. Now, some local residents are not happy because it's raising property values and making it less affordable for people to live. And when SpaceX and Elon Musk comes into an area, they throw their weight around. Like, they are tough negotiators, and they want this and this and this and this and this. And if you don't like it, tough. And so far, local and state officials are happy with that because, as I say, SpaceX is bringing thousands of jobs, lots of money, investment in that area. And, you know, Elon Musk recently gave $30 million to local schools in downtown. And that was really, I think, part of an effort not to win over hearts and minds of local residents, but to make the school system better for employees, and to improve the quality of life for them in going to downtown Brownsville. You know, it's if you're living in Los Angeles working at SpaceX, it's kind of a difficult sell to move across the country to South Texas because it's not LA, it's not Houston, right? It's just not sort of the same type of you know, place to live, and it's much hotter, things like that. So he's trying to make it more appealing to people because it's clear to me that he has gone all in on South Texas as the future of SpaceX and Starship. He likes the location. He likes the environment in terms of working with state and local officials. He has that launch range, so it's much easier for him. He doesn't have to battle with a bunch of other companies at Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral in Florida.
Interesting. With SpaceX, do you know if they're planning to move their headquarters anytime soon, away from Hawthorne to Texas at all?
I haven't heard anything about that, and it would be difficult for me to see that, at least for a while, because the core of their business is still the Falcon 9 rocket, the Falcon Heavy, and the Dragon spacecraft, and all of those development and build activities take place in Hawthorne. And that's where, I mean, they're based in LA for a reason. I mean, that LA is like the hotbed for engineering, aerospace engineering talent in the United States. I mean, there's all of a lot of the major space companies are based in LA because that's where the greatest nucleus of talent is. Mm-hmm. So I would suspect they'll stay there, but who knows, man? Mm-hmm. Elon could decide, you know, the governor of California could do something tomorrow that Elon doesn't like. And he could say, okay, we're moving the headquarters to Austin. He seems to like Austin now, mm-hmm. or Brownsville even. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Elon can change his mind, often does, and then quickly changes things.
Yeah.
So who knows? I don't see that happening for now, but it could.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. So perhaps the most important question for last, Dogecoin. So Elon Musk says that he will take a literal Dogecoin and put it on the literal moon. Is he kidding around? Like, what is he talking about here? Do you have any ideas?
No, he's not kidding around. I mean, I don't think he's kidding around. You know, when they launched their first Cargo Dragon spacecraft, this one was not going to the International Space Station. It was just a test flight on the second launch of the Falcon 9 rocket. You know, he put a wheel of Gruyere cheese in the vehicle because he liked this Monty Python skit, you know, a cheesy comestible, like, you know, the cheese shop sketch. It was a lark, right? When he launched his Falcon Heavy, of course, he put his Tesla Roadster. And I remember that distinctly. That was in early 2018, or maybe it was late 2017, when he was like late night at Twitter. I was about to go to bed, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to launch my cherry red Tesla to Mars. And I didn't know whether it was a joke or not. I was like, is he serious? Is he launching his Tesla to Mars? I was like, no way. So I emailed him. I said, are you kidding? He's like, no, I'm serious. And so, like, he launched his Tesla. And now it turns out, like, he'd offered NASA a free launch. Said, hey, you know, we're testing out the Falcon Heavy rocket. I don't have a payload. If you guys want to put something on it, here's a free launch. By the way, it's got a 50% chance of success. Right. So they didn't take him up on it. So he's like, okay, you know, I'll launch a Tesla and it'll get some attention. And it did. You know, it's good for his brand. But it also was just sort of a spectacle. And it raised the company's profile even more. So if he says he's going to put a Dogecoin on the moon, he's probably going to put a Dogecoin on the moon. I mean, mm-hmm. that first mission for NASA, where they're just sending a starship down to the surface of the moon. I mean, that thing could take tons of stuff down to the moon and back. So yeah, sure. I mean, why not?
Yeah. I mean, he would have to like make a Dogecoin first, you know?
Yeah. He'll have to make a Dogecoin. He'll get someone at SpaceX to do it. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. He tweets about that stuff. And I think, I don't know this for sure, but he's obviously got a super stressful life, right? I mean, one of the richest people in the world. So you've got everybody and their brother coming at him wanting stuff. And he's got the pressure of dealing with NASA and the FCC and everyone, like all these government agencies for Tesla and SpaceX and just running both of these companies and Neuralink and the Boring Company and all this other stuff and having a personal life. And it's just, you know, the life of Elon Musk is pretty hectic and pretty damn stressful. So I think he goes to Twitter to burn stress. Like that's his, like, it's kind of like a drug to him. He gets on there and larks around. And like, but when I notice when he says stuff about space, it's generally pretty serious. So like, yeah. I mean, if he says he's going to put a Dogecoin on the moon, why not?
Yeah. It's crazy. Fun stuff, actually. Especially with Doge price going to the moon, too, today. It's insane. Yeah. It's been a crazy fun interview, Eric. Again, I want to plug your book here. I definitely suggest this book, Lift Off, Eric Berger. Check it out on Amazon. Fun stories about SpaceX's early days. I got a lot of insights and this interview has been fantastic. I love just chatting about all these topics. I feel like what's going on right now with SpaceX is something for the history books. This is stuff that's really changing, you know, the course of humanity and what we'll be doing for centuries ahead, if time allows. But thank you again, Eric. How can people kind of keep up with what you're doing and kind of follow your updates?
Sure. I mean, I write for space for a website called Ars Technica, and I'm on Twitter most frequently at SciGuySpace.
Okay, cool. Now I'll go ahead and link to those to your Twitter profile and that to Ars Technica in the video description below. All right. Thanks, Eric, again, and we'll hope to chat again about further stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.